Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we find out why baby boomers seem to be key for the auto industry. And then, speaking of transportation, the author of the new book, The Great American Jetpack, joins us to take a look at the history of individual flight. But first, one of the cities that's really been in the headlines of late is Hamtramck. Governor Snyder has declared the 2.1 square mile city within Detroit is under financial emergency, and it could soon come under the control of yet another state-appointed emergency manager. But facing tough times is nothing new for Hamtramck. Starting from its beginning as a home for Polish immigrants, this city continues to be one of the most diverse communities in the state. We wanted to learn more about the unique history of Hamtramck, and so we turned to someone who was born in Hamtramck. Greg Kowalski is chairman of the Hamtramck Historical Commission. He joins us now. Greg, tell us about your family's history with Hamtramck, going back to your grandpa.
I only knew one of my grandparents. The others had died before I was born, and I was very young. So my one grandfather I knew, and he came here from Poland when he was about 14 years old and came here alone and didn't speak English. So that shows you the kind of the guts and tenacity people had back then to do something like that. And he ended up, first in Pennsylvania and then coming up here for the auto industry, like so many others did at that period.
And what was it about Hamtramck that became a magnet for Polish immigrants? Was it just one family after another spread the word? How did it happen?
Well, it's a complex kind of situation, but it really can be traced to the Dodge Main Factory, which opened here in 1910. At that point, Hamtramck was a little village. It was 2 square miles. It's still 2 square miles, but it was 2 square miles, 3,500 people. And by 1920, it was 48,000 people in those 2 square miles. And almost all of them were Polish immigrants who came here to work at Dodge Main and 23 other factories that sprang up around the city, mainly to feed the Dodge Main factory. And it was a lot through family ties. You know, one family comes here and brings the others over, and the word spreads, and it just gets kind of like a snowball. It just rolls and gets bigger and bigger, and it certainly got bigger here.
And how did Hamtramck fare during the Great Depression?
Hamtramck fared terribly during the Great Depression. We were so closely tied to the auto industry that our unemployment rate was about 60%, and that's 60. Not 16, but 60%. So it would put a tremendous strain on the city and on all the social organizations here and on the churches here, which tried to help fill that, to help fill the needs of the people as well, too.
And then moving through the 40s and the 50s, did the war help? The war effort help things out, hurt things? How did that play out?
Well, it helped in a way in that Dodge Main grew to be such a gigantic factory. It became one of the largest factories in the world, and during the war years employed about 45,000 people. So it was a huge operation, and financially it helped the city, but only to a certain extent. Hamtramck's population started to decline after 1930 when it hit 56,000 people. But keep in mind that mainly these were quite poor people who lived in the city and who moved to the city, and it was a struggle. I mean, we're in a current financial crisis, of course, that you're all aware of. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking right now in front of me. I picked this up from our files yesterday. This is a newspaper headline that says, "City is broke. 450 workers go payless." That's from the June 1st, 1945 issue of the Hamtramck Citizen newspaper.
Wow.
So we can trace our financial problems even further back to the Great Depression, and then they continued on after that as well.
1971 wasn't a good year, was it?
1971 was a terrible year. In fact, and even that was not the worst year in the city's history. In 1971, the city was very close to official bankruptcy. And in fact, it really was. It did go bankrupt at that point, too. And the state stepped in and straightened the finances out to a degree. But that couldn't even really compare to the situation we were facing when Dodge Main closed in 1979 and we lost a quarter of our income tax base. So that had a really devastating potential effect on the city, and really that could have threatened the very existence of the city, and that was avoided when the Pole Town plant was proposed, though, about a year after Dodge Main closed.
And that was General Motors then, the Detroit Hamtramck Assembly plant.
Exactly, where they're producing the Chevy Volt right now.
So it made up the loss to a point. But there was a lot of controversy that Hamtramck had to endure with that pole town plant. Talk about that. A lot of emotions.
There was a lot of emotions, but frankly, it really wasn't Hamtramck that had to endure too much of that, because we really only lost a handful of homes to that project, and the empty Dodge Main factory was cleared. The vast majority of the demolitions, and we're talking about 1,500 homes, two churches, a hospital where my mom worked, actually, and a variety of businesses were all demolished to make way for the plant, but that was all on the Detroit side of the border. Hamtramck lost very little and gained quite a bit from that. So there was a bit of controversy here as well, but it really was Detroit that took the brunt of that.
But even getting the pole town plant up and running, the city still had trouble, and you had state-appointed
right.
emergency financial manager Lou Schimmel in there from 2000 to 2007, but that didn't
That's
last,
right.
did it?
No, you know, because the economy has, I hate to say it, but it's really conspired against us. You know, we all suffered from the great collapse of 2008, and we lost American Axle closed, and our economic base deteriorated. And we're still not a very, you know, we're not a rich community by any means. So it's always a struggle for us. And we have, just like other cities do, a large pension obligation. And it's just a struggle. Costs keep going up, but our revenue keeps going down. And then the state does things like eliminate personal property taxes and cut state revenue sharing. So that puts more and more constraints upon us. But one thing we have to learn, have learned, and I really want to stress this, is that we've gone through so many of these crises going all the way back to the 1930s, because they were in the 1950s as well, by the way,
mm-hmm.
and 40s and 50s and 60s. We had a whole series of these. We've learned that you can endure, that you can get past these things, and the vibrancy of the city is no less than it has ever been. It is really a strong, vibrant community. We're facing financial problems. We'll get past those financial problems.
Greg, for people who are listening to us in other parts of Michigan who have never mm-hmm. been to Hamtramck, give us kind of a tour of the city, if you will. What would people find?
Certainly. And in fact, we, the Hamtramck Historical Commission, does do tours of the city. And we get quite a few of them, in fact. We get a lot of people coming from all across Michigan, from Ohio. I've got a group coming in from Cleveland later this year. And people love it. What do they see? Well, they see, we usually like to show them the St. Florian Church, which is one of the principal elements that really built Hamtramck along with Dodge Main. It was really a cornerstone of the community and remains so today. But we also take them to places like the Polish Art Center. There's a Polish meat market. There's a bakery that has been in operation for over 100 years now. You see the tight-knit nature of the neighborhoods there, because our homes are in 30-foot lots. And they hear the history of how that came about. And they get a sense of what really, you know, the vibrancy that's going on in the city.
But the city has moved from being such a densely mm-hmm. Polish population to mm-hmm. extremely diverse. Give us a sense of
sure.
what other ethnicities and groups are making their home in Hamtramck these
well,
days.
Well, we are certainly one of the most diverse cities in the state of Michigan. We are about 20% Polish, about 20% Bangladeshi, about 20% African-American, and about 20% everything else you can think of. People from all over the world have come to Hamtramck, and it is truly a real mix of different people. Where I live in my particular street in Hamtramck, my one neighbor is Bosnian, and she doesn't speak English. We communicate with sign language. The neighbors on the other side are Bangladeshi. They have just moved in. I have Ukrainian neighbors, Polish neighbors, African-American neighbors, and everybody you can imagine living there now. In fact, one of our main streets has been honorarily named Bangladesh Avenue because there's so many of the Bangladesh stories have opened there. And so you see this incredible mixture. And when we do the bus tours, I tell people, look at the people on the street. You're going to see people in burqas and turbans and babushkas and saris and everything imaginable. So you see all kinds of reflections of different cultures here, many different stores reflecting very many different nationalities.
Greg Kowalski, what can other communities in Michigan who are in perilous financial straits, what can they learn from Hamtramck?
Learn to draw on your own strength. That not everything is tied to the finances of a city. So much of it is really depends on the strength and character of the people in the city. If you refuse to let your city, you know, let it die, it will not die. We've got people, an enormous amount of volunteers. We're getting ready right now to open the Hamtramck Historical Museum, which we hope to have in operations by Labor Day. We're working on a building right now to do that, and that's going to be reflective of all the nationalities in Hamtramck. Now, does that sound to you like a dying city? It's the richness of the town that comes from the spirit of the people. So look into yourself and see what you can do for your own community, and you'll be surprised.
We've been speaking with the chairman of the Hamtramck Historical Commission, Greg Kowalski, and quite a spokesman for his hometown. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Still to come, every day it seems we're making technological progress, new inventions, new devices, changing our lives. But as engineers think up new ideas and designs, how about that moral compass? What about the ethics behind technology? We'll speak to a researcher who is asking those very questions. That conversation comes up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, ask any baby boomer who grew up watching science fiction movies after school, maybe Lost in Space, or maybe watching the Jetsons on the Saturday morning cartoons. Strapping on a jetpack and zipping through the sky seemed like a done deal. So, why are we in 2013 and we're still waiting to fly like a bird? We got astronauts on the moon. We have an orbiting space station. Where are the jetpacks? That's the question my next guest asks in his new book, The Great American Jetpack, The Quest for the Ultimate Individual Lift Device. It's written by Southeast Michigan native Steve Lato, who joins us now. And Steve, I am so happy to ask you the question, where's my jetpack?
You know, for such a simple question, it's got a very convoluted answer. And the amazing thing is that, you know, jetpacks and their ilk were first developed in the 50s and 60s. And you're right, we're still walking like animals. but that's because it turns out that for such a simple question, it's got a very, very complicated answer.
Now, do I over-exaggerate that view that we had growing up, that we would be able to be flying by the 21st century? It just seemed like
it would be
so possible.
It was the most overpromised technology of all time. James Bond flew one in the opening scene of Thunderball. It made appearances on Gilligan's Island and Lost in Space. And there was a time when these things were ubiquitous, which is one of my favorite words.
Yes,
where it seemed like everybody, you know, had these things. They were everywhere, and they were being touted as soon we will all have these. I quoted a guy in the 1950s who said that an individual lift device. It's so easy to operate, a trained bear could fly one. And that was an engineer who worked for the company that was building a thing called the Hiller Flying Platform. And it turns out he was exaggerating a little bit, but that's one of the things that you see through this entire development. It's 50 and 60 years of just exaggerating by the engineers and the marketers who are building the jetpacks.
Well, take us back to show us some history. When we talk about how far back that dream of the jetpack would go, you wrote about a colonel at West Point even before the U.S. entered World War II. What happened to get him thinking about a jetpack?
Well, it's interesting because the idea of being able to fly, of course, is something that's, I think it's actually instinctive. I think everyone's born with the notion that you wish you could just step up into the sky and fly around like a bird.
Why do you think we love Superman? Superman was my superhero over Batman because Superman could fly.
Absolutely. And the thing about it is that they were born with that innate desire. And, you know, even in the 1930s, there were science fiction comic books. Buck Rogers, for instance, had a flying device, a little thing he could put on his back and allowed him to zoom around in the sky. And that idea, you know, of science fiction is often like that, where it's just, you know, science fiction is just slightly ahead of real science. And there were scientists and actually Army personnel who came up with the idea and said, you know, maybe we should get something that allows a soldier to jump around in the battlefield, maybe jump over obstacles or landmines or Army tanks. And so this one colonel came up with this idea and pitched it to his superiors and said, why don't we put on a bid and ask companies if they want to try to develop the idea of a personal lift device? And so they put the contract out, and some companies bid on it and came up with some ideas.
And so how well did those ideas work? Clearly not well enough.
Well, interestingly enough, the ideas always worked a little bit. So the most successful jetpack, the rocket belt that you see on the opening scenes of Thunderball, for instance.
Sure.
That thing could fly for 21 seconds. Now, they never told you that. So if you saw it on TV, they'd cut to it flying and they'd cut away from it. And so people would say, yeah, I saw this guy flying with a jetpack, not realizing that you could fly it for 21 seconds. If you were a couple seconds late coming down, you'd fall like a rock.
Ooh.
And it burns hundreds of dollars of fuel every few seconds.
Ooh.
So it's highly impractical. And that's the thing, is the rocket belt promised so much, but it had this one fatal flaw, and that was its flight time was severely limited. And once you try to solve that problem, some other problem pops up. It's like a puzzle where you've got three pieces. No matter how you put them together, there's a fourth one missing.
Wow. Now, when we think about during the 1950s, when we had such advances in rocket technology taking us into the 1960s, when our space program really took off, how did the research and design of a jetpack track with all of the rocket technology?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that they developed this rocket belt that would fly for 21 seconds, and it made for some great demonstrations. I mean, they flew it over the Super Bowl. They flew it over the Olympics. And somebody said, well, is there any practical application for this? And they did actually use some of the technology in the space program, the motors, the device that powered the jetpack. That would make a lot of sense in outer space. But again, how much fuel can you carry up there, you know? The X-1 Bell aircraft, the first one that broke the sound barrier, it wasn't powered by the engine from a jetpack, but it was using the same technology on all its control surfaces. So the technology did bleed into other projects, but the one thing that everyone remembered was there's that guy on TV flying a jetpack 5, 10, 20 years ago. Whatever happened to that?
Sure.
And that's the thing. Now, interestingly enough, there's a company in Walled Lake, Michigan called Williams International.
Sure, we remember Williams, yes.
Yes, and Williams was founded by a guy who worked at Chrysler, and he was one of the guys who shoehorned a turbine engine into a jet car back in the early 1950s. Which people have forgotten that there was actually jet-powered cars on the road in the 50s and 60s, and especially in Detroit. And so when Williams left Chrysler, he started Williams International. One of the first things he did there was meet with the guys from Bell and say, you know something, instead of using hydrogen peroxide rocket motors, why don't you just put a really tiny jet engine on a man's back? And so they actually turned the rocket belt into a jet belt. Now, the jet belt would fly literally for 5 or 10 minutes, which resolved the issue of the short flight time, but now it's heavier and it costs a lot more.
All right.
The little engine on the guy's back probably cost $100,000 in 1964.
Ooh. So that does not help it to progress to being hanging in every closet.
No, that won't put one in every garage, no.
I'm speaking with author Steve Leto. His book, The Great American Jetpack, The Quest for the Ultimate Individual Lift Device, and it's published by the Chicago Review Press. Looking at that dream of flying like Superman, flying like a bird, and it's interesting. So as we are sitting here in 2013 with all the technological know-how that we have, what are the main issues that are keeping this thing from happening?
Well, like I said before, it's the idea is there. The idea that you can fly something and not require a pilot, for instance, to operate the device, that technology was proven, you know, 50 years ago. The question is, what can you do to increase the flight time? And you know, a jetpack would solve that problem. But then there's a bigger problem, and that is, what happens if you're up in the sky and you lose power? If you're driving along the lodge in your car and you lose power, you coast over to the side of the road and you walk away from it and call 911. If you're in an individual lift device and you lose power, you plummet like a rock.
Ooh.
Now, engineers call that lift degradation, okay?
That's a nice term for something horrible.
Yeah, they have euphemisms for all these things.
Yeah.
And the problem is if you suffer from lift degradation, anything above, like, say, 5 or 10 feet off the ground, you're going to get hurt when you fall, especially with this big thing attached to your back.
Okay.
So that's a problem you're always going to have. Now, there are people who've tried to upgrade or update the various flying devices that are out there. A lot of people may have seen a thing called a JetLev, which is a water-powered jetpack. A guy in Florida actually developed that after seeing Thunderball. And it actually runs down to a tether that's on a little boat, and it feeds water up to the jetpack. But the problem is that you can't fly any further than the length of your tether. So you're kind of limited there.
Bad, yeah.
Then, of course, there's the Frenchman, Yves Rossi, who's often called the Jet Man. He has a wing he built that's got four jet engines on it, and he drops out of helicopters and airplanes, and he flies. And he can fly around up there like a bird 10, 15 minutes at 200 miles an hour. But the problem is he can't take off from flat ground. So, again, every time somebody solves one problem, it creates another problem. And nobody yet has figured out how to make one of these things fly for a long period of time, not cost $1 trillion, and not kill you the moment you run out of power.
Because you'd be too low to be able to trigger a parachute.
And some of these devices they built did have ballistic parachutes on board, which can deploy pretty quickly at a pretty decent altitude. But even so, you've got to be above, say, 30 or 40 feet at least to get it to work right. And so you would suffer some injuries. And you know, I've joked with people, said, you know something, I'm kind of glad we don't have these things everywhere yet. Because can you imagine, you know, the people that you don't like driving with in traffic, they have these devices, and they're zipping around over your house, for instance, or in your backyard, you know, going to work and taking a shortcut. And what happens when they run into trouble? You know, and suddenly they land on your roof.
Guarantee they'd be texting, as they did too. What was it that when I remember watching in 2005, it was that press conference for the MTV Video Awards and Diddy, yes. Sean Combs, zipped in. What was that device that he used with that rocket on his back?
It was a rocket belt, but that was actually a stunt. I interviewed the man who did that flight, and there's a couple companies out there that do demonstrations with rocket belts, and you can hire them. Costs a fortune, but you can hire them. And what they do is they fly a guy in wearing a helmet and a flight suit, and then when he lands, they cut to a different guy taking off the helmet, and that's, you know, P. Diddy. He didn't actually fly that thing in. To learn how to fly a rocket belt takes literally hundreds of practice flights and tens of thousands of dollars in fuel, and most people get injured once or twice trying to learn how to do it.
So that P. Diddy stunt was very much like the Queen and Daniel Craig not jumping out of that airplane at the Olympics in London last summer.
You're telling me that wasn't her?
Or him.
Exact same. Yeah, exact same thing.
Steve, based on all the research you did for your book, The Great American Jetpack, honestly, in your heart of hearts, how likely do you think it will be that we will ever be able to fly ourselves to work or school?
It'll probably never happen for the average person. These devices are becoming more common. They're becoming less expensive. There are people building these devices, and I've interviewed three or four guys who are building them like in their backyards or in their basements, and this is crazy. But the problem always is what happens when you lose power, and no company in their right mind would build a device that would kill a person the first time it was mishandled. So I don't think they'll ever hit the market in that respect. But I talked to a guy who said, you know, Steve, if you want to build one of these things and you got, you know, $25,000 or $30,000, he goes, I can give you the plans. You can build one tomorrow. You know, so they're buildable. It's just how safe they are for the average person.
You just figure, though, somebody once upon a time said the very same thing to the Wright brothers, and then Kitty Hawk happened and we became airborne. So
there's a little difference here, though. You and I aren't flying our own airplanes.
That's true.
Go up in airplanes, but they're flown by others.
Fair enough. So we'll keep watching our Lost in Space and our Jetsons and Fireball XL5 and our sci-fi movies and just kind of fantasizing.
Exactly.
The Great American Jetpack, the quest for the ultimate individual lift device, published by the Chicago Review Press and written by Birmingham, Michigan native Steve Leto. Pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we do it again soon.
Thank you. I had a great time.
And we want to hear from you. What technology, what device do you wish would be invented? We're talking about that right now on our Facebook page, and it seems like teleporters are the most popular invention at this point. I would vote for that as well. But what do you think? Join in on the conversation. You can find us at Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And, of course, you can always find us on the Stateside link at michiganradio.org. All right, let's continue looking at engineering and technology, things that touch our lives every minute of every day. Just as the jetpack is an example, technology is always expanding. But as engineers design and they think up new ideas, what's happening at the intersection of technology and ethics? And what's the price we pay when engineers overlook that moral compass? These are questions that my next guest is focused on as she helps train the engineers of the future. Dr. Cynthia Finelli is the director of the Center for Research on Learning and Teaching in Engineering, and she's a research associate professor at the University of Michigan, and she's part of a team called E3. That stands for Exploring Ethical Decision-Making in Engineering. It's a group of engineering educators from many colleges and universities, and these teachers study engineering ethics. So Dr. Cynthia Finelli is kind enough to join us in the studio. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, give me some sense, if you can. Tell us, how important is it for engineers to keep a moral compass as they design technology?
I think it's pretty critical. Engineers really have the capacity to affect multiple levels of people, I guess, with decisions that they make. So whereas some professions might impact a single individual with a decision that's ethical or not ethical, engineers really have the potential to impact a great many more people.
So I would suspect if I was trying to come up as a layperson with a good example of what happens with the lapse of ethics in engineering, the Titanic might come to mind.
Yes, the Titanic is an example. Other good examples are the Kansas City Skywalk collapse at the Hyatt Regency. In the early 1900s, or 1980s, sorry.
Yes.
Things like the space shuttle, the Challenger.
Oh, the O-rings.
Yes.
And I imagine as the students leave your classroom and go out into the world, that's where they get met with, like, the folks in finance, and they want to see costs, they want to see savings realized.
Yep, exactly.
And there's pressure to streamline or cut some corners. And so they have to have a pretty strong moral compass.
Yeah, and it's hard for engineers who are students who aren't really exposed to the real world to know how to make decisions, to have the right framework for or foundation for making ethical decisions, because we often don't give them those opportunities as undergraduates.
And they're lost in their design challenge, aren't they, in that sense? And so how does a professional engineer or a student who's learning, as they're in the middle of whatever that design challenge is, where is that line between innovation and technology and the moral standards? Is it clear and obvious, or is it fuzzy?
Well, I think a different way to put that might be, how can we help prepare students to have the right perspectives to make ethical decisions? So what we find in a lot of cases in the research that we're doing is that places that are really successful at introducing students to ethics have the students position themselves in ethical dilemmas that are not black and white issues, that are really hard to struggle with, and sort of play with the balance between the trade-offs between safety and cost and other issues. So have students struggle with these maybe in teams, in an opportunity where it's kind of a safe environment, and there really are the implications for failing or making unethical decisions are much less.
Can you give us for instance, what kind of scenario might students be presented with?
So for instance, giving students the design specifications for a situation and asking them to, put themselves in a variety of different circumstances and think about what decisions they might make and what the pros and cons of each of those situations might be. Have students in a team play the devil's advocate. Maybe someone serve as the supervisor of the team who's really pushing to make cost savings in spite of some of these issues that might be more obvious from the junior engineering perspective. So just really have students struggle with some of these issues in their small team environment.
Which they'll be doing once they get out into the big
world.
Definitely.
So giving them some practice before they get out there really is helpful.
Dr. Cynthia Finelli, who's director of the Center for Research on Learning and Teaching in Engineering at the University of Michigan, and a member of E3, that stands for Exploring Ethical Decision-Making in Engineering. And thank you very much for talking with us today on the program.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
To come, we'll find out why baby boomers appear to hold the key to success for the auto industry. That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. Ever heard the word derecho? Well, if you haven't, it's a safe bet after the challenging weather we could get today and tonight, you will know that word. There's a 240-mile band of severe, dangerous thunderstorms that are drawing a bead right now in the Midwest and the Northeast with the potential to affect one in five Americans. And this continuous line of storms could trigger this unusual weather event called a derecho. Here to explain from the National Weather Service Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma, is Russ Snyder. First, give us an overview. Russ, how big is this line of powerful thunderstorms?
Well, I have to make sure folks know that the thunderstorms haven't really formed yet. And this is really a forecast that there's potential that we develop one of these lines, very intense lines of thunderstorms called derechos. That's an outside possibility. That's a very extreme event, and we'll be hopeful that it doesn't occur, but conditions are favorable for damaging winds and large hail across a large swath of the Midwest, including extreme southern Michigan, this afternoon and evening.
And what is a derecho? I have never heard that word until today.
Well, derechos have been around for a long time, and if you have gone through Michigan over the years, a lot of times, a lot of downed trees and power lines. They're extremely well-organized lines of thunderstorms. They move extremely rapidly, 50 to 60, even 70 miles an hour, so they get on you very quickly, and they are accompanied by winds of 70 and sometimes up to 100-mile-an-hour winds over a widespread area. So there is a potential for that across northern Illinois, extreme southern Michigan, as well as northern Indiana into Ohio later this afternoon into the evening hours. And so we're going to have to monitor the situation very carefully, and we want everybody in that risk area to stay weather aware.
Because I'm gathering when you talk about fast moving, does that mean that if there's a sense it's coming, you're not going to have a lot of time to take cover?
Yeah, when they're moving 60 to 70 miles an hour, that's, you know, at least double the speed of most normal thunderstorms. And so folks, a lot of times with derechos out on lakes, including Lake Michigan and smaller lakes, people get surprised at how quickly the storm is upon you. And the winds, if a derecho-like system forms, the very strong winds hit almost immediately as the storm approaches. So you're in 70 to 80 mile-an-hour winds in a very short period of time. So things go from warm and humid to very chaotic, dangerous situation in a very short period of time. So you want to be weather aware and have a plan of action. And certainly if you're outdoors or on lakes, you want to really monitor the weather carefully and take action early because these things get on you really quickly.
And Russ, tell us, how does the wind pattern of the derecho differ from the pattern of what we're all very familiar with, which is tornado?
Well, a tornado is a rotating storm, and folks have seen them certainly just right near my home in Moore. I live in Norman, Oklahoma, just about 4 miles from the path. Those are extreme examples of what tornadoes can be like. A derecho is more like a line of thunderstorms, but it's a really super intense line of thunderstorms with very powerful winds, and they move across areas at a very rapid clip. And so they come upon you quickly, and they can cause widespread power outages as well as fatalities for those that find them, particularly for those that find themselves outside or on open water when they hit.
And it strikes me, if it's a line, is this a thick line, or is it something that once it hits you, it'll pass pretty quickly because it's so fast moving?
Yeah, derechos pass pretty quickly. The intense winds are probably in the first 10 to 30 minutes, and then you get some rain and lightning. So the lightning threat will persist after a derecho goes by, and there can be some fairly heavy rain behind them. But because they're moving so quickly, it's a fairly quick event as opposed to something that goes on much of the night.
Forewarned is forearmed. Russ Snyder, National Weather Service Storm Prediction Center there in Norman, Oklahoma. Thanks for the heads up, Russ.
You're very welcome, and please stay weather aware this afternoon and evening.
It often seems as though the advertisers of America are eyeing that young audience. Look at much of the popular media these days. If you're over 54 or 55, you could certainly be forgiven for getting the idea that advertisers and ad agencies don't much care what you want to buy. Well, a new study by the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute proves that, at least when it comes to buying cars, the baby boomers count. That study finds that 55 to 64-year-old baby boomers are 15 times more likely to buy a new car or truck than 18 to 24-year-olds. Let's talk more about why baby boomers appear to hold the key to success for auto companies as we welcome back John Wilkonowicz. He's an independent auto analyst. John joins us now from Boston. Welcome back to Stateside, John.
Good to be back with you.
So why is the probability so much higher that a baby boomer is going to go in and buy a car and not a younger 20-something? Is it a matter of having money or having the desire in the first place?
I think it's mostly money and a little bit of the desire. The older baby boomers, and I'm one of them.
As am I.
grew up in an auto era. When we were teenagers in the 60s, the car was the most important part of our social atmosphere. You had to have a car to be anybody or anywhere. And, you know, that translates into the way we feel about cars today.
Yeah.
They were important then. They're still important to us now. They always will be important. That's sort of point number one.
Okay.
Whereas I think today's younger people have many other interests to capture their sort of share of mind, and a lot of it has to do with electronic media.
Okay, so because for us that was your identity. Even if you drove Dad's beater, it really did say who you were. And here in Southeast Michigan, we had the cruisers. They would cruise Telegraph if you were the west side, Gratiot if you were from the east side, and then of course the Woodward would go split it right up the middle, and that you're right, that was your life. And you know what I've noticed? Like, I can remember we dragged our parents to the Secretary of State's office on the very day we turned 16 to get our license. But that another U of M study finds the percentage of 19-year-olds with a driver's license is under 70%, lowest level in nearly 30 years then.
That's a shocking number, because when I was 16, I didn't know anyone in my class who didn't get the license on their birthday.
Yes. And I know, as the parent of a 19-year-old, she turned 16 in October, and we didn't go in for the license till April. And that is, I've seen that all around her circle of friends.
It's just not as urgent anymore.
Well, what does that mean then for companies like GM and Chrysler, who we know are recovering from what was a near-death experience? What does that mean for them and all of the auto industry looking forward?
Well, long term, I think it means a slight decline in per capita consumption of vehicles, but I'm not as worried about that. I think what's really causing the disparity in the numbers between young and old today is finances.
Mm.
You know, baby boomers are staying in their jobs longer than people ever have. Many baby boomers intend to work till 70. Some say they'll never retire. That doesn't make it easy for young people to find a job, particularly in a very constrained job atmosphere like we have today.
And then also just the way the millennials and Gen Y are living. When I think of young folks I know that are living in a big city, and if they need a car, they get a Zip car.
That's absolutely right. So, you know, in some ways, marketing and technology have come to the rescue. If they have a license, they can get a Zip car. Public transportation, I mean, here in Boston, public transportation is fabulous. Most young people that live in the city don't have a car.
Yeah.
And many don't even have a driver's license. It's just not an expense they want to endure. One thing I've noticed, that I do study various generations as part of understanding who buys what vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I've noticed is that today's Gen Y people like to remain mobile. They don't want to saddle themselves down with furniture and lots of possessions. They want to be able to move where the job is or move where the spirit moves them. And, you know, that's a pretty smart way to live your life, unencumbered with stuff.
Yes.
And, you know, if you don't really need a car just becomes an added burden on the finances. They'd rather go out to eat every week in a nice restaurant, go to a ball game, do things that will make them happy rather than have the burden of paying car insurance and the maintenance and payment on that car.
So if I'm a marketing executive sitting at the Renaissance Center for General Motors, or I'm out in Auburn Hills for Chrysler or in Dearborn for Ford or any of the other auto companies, what am I to make of this?
I think there's been a bit of an overemphasis on the young buyer, and maybe not in an unrealistic fashion. I mean, everybody looks to the young buyer as the future of the industry.
Right.
So you do have to capture them, because one day these older buyers are going to die out of the market, or at least age out of the market.
Thanks a lot, John.
Well, I'm probably older than you are. But in any case, so you do have to look to the future. But I honestly think there's been an inordinate attempt to capture young people at the expense of the older buyer, such that vehicles are now tailored toward customers who can't afford to buy them.
Very interesting. Give me some examples, for instance.
Well, I think, for example, I think some of the electronic technology that goes into vehicles that an older person might buy is in some ways maybe a waste, or it can even be off-putting. I mean, I remember an example. I'll give you an example from the distant past so that we don't embarrass anyone in the industry. But the 1995 Buick Riviera,
okay.
If you looked at the demographics of that car, it was bought by people over 65. Pretty much the whole Buick brand was at that time. And it had a touch screen in it.
Hmm.
That frustrated the buyer and actually, in my mind, minimized the sales of the car, because they'd take a test drive and say, I can't deal with that. I'm not going to deal with that. I'll buy something else that doesn't have it.
And I think that story is echoed in offerings that are out right now. But as you say, we won't have any red faces as we listen. But you really do make an interesting point that it might behoove the designers and the engineers to remember who's actually buying the lion's share of the vehicles.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that needs to be considered is the vehicle's design. Baby boomers, as I said, grew up in the 60s. We still like that 60s look. I actually worked on the team that developed the 2005 Mustang, which is a retro car.
Yes.
And which was very, very popular with the baby boom generation. A good part of the work that I did on that program was to look back and see how much retro we wanted to dial into the design.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I think we got that one pretty right. But in the design community, retro is viewed as almost like cheating. It's like, well, I can't come up with something unique on my own, so I'll copy something from the past. Well, no, it really isn't that. Retro design can significantly increase the sales of a vehicle, particularly to an older buyer. I mean, you know, take that Mustang as an example.
Yeah.
Most of us in the late 60s dreamed about owning a Mustang or a GTO.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't afford it. Well, now maybe we can, and now we can have that Mustang.
Yeah.
And if it evokes that time when we were 17 and the world was our oyster, just getting in that car and driving it every day or looking at it in the driveway can excite the older buyer, the baby boomer buyer. So I think there's a place for retro design, I think is what I'm saying.
I'm speaking with John Wilkonowicz, who's an independent auto analyst. He's joining us from Boston as we kind of explore who is buying the cars. And it certainly seems that the baby boomer buyers are the key to success for the auto industry. But so, John, I want to ask you about looking outside of the U.S. What about patterns in key markets overseas, such as, say, China? My understanding is that they run to get their licenses and that the average age of a Buick buyer in China is 32.
Yeah, and they sell a lot more Buicks in China than they do here.
Yeah.
China is kind of maybe what the U.S. market was in the 1920s in terms of automobiles. Everybody wants to own one. They want to have an exciting one. They can't wait to drive. They can't wait to buy a bigger and better car next time. It's a very upwardly mobile society. You know, and that's where we used to be. I'm afraid that we're headed down the other side of that curve now.
Mm-hmm.
So things are a little different, and that's also true in Europe. You know, what's happening in the United States, very similar things are happening in Europe, and in some ways have been happening longer there.
Yeah.
Their cities are so congested, you almost can't have a car. And, you know, many city centers in Europe are prohibiting vehicular traffic.
And in Europe, you're able to get around and live your life without having a car, which in the suburban, you know, landscape of America was well nigh impossible.
Well, that's right. And I mean, public transportation in European cities is superb, and it's also superb between cities. You know, the rail service between cities in Europe is outstanding. And that's something we still don't have here in the U.S. We gave all that up in the 50s and 60s.
When we talk about overseas and saying how they're rushing for vehicles in China, there are jobs then for the young people to be able to have the money to buy the cars there?
Yeah, I mean, even though their growth has slowed in China, they're still growing. So, yes, there is increasing money for young people to drive cars. If you look at the motorization rate in China, it's still relatively low. So there is a lot of upward potential. And again, we keep hearing the news about how China is slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that the growth rate has slowed down, not that they're not growing anymore. They are still growing at like 6% a year. And, you know, that's pretty strong growth.
But back to here in America, where it does seem to be the 55 to 64-year-olds who are really driving the car sales. So the challenge, not only to the automakers, but to the advertisers who construct the marketing campaigns, what would you say that challenge would be?
Well, I think they've been moving to social media and many of the types of outlets that the young people are interested in. I would suggest that they maybe need to strike a better balance in sticking with some of the traditional media, like television, for example,
mm-hmm.
which will appeal to the older buyer. So I, again, like many things, once you're over 54, you're kind of forgotten in terms of the demographics of America. Marketers are not interested in you anymore. Well, because it's the baby boomer now, that huge baby boomer generation has moved into this over 54 group, I think marketers need to reconsider. I really do. But, you know, if you look at the demographic of the marketers themselves, they tend to be in their 30s. And they, as far as they're concerned, the over 54 buyer is just a dinosaur that's not even worth considering. But, you know, they do so at their peril if they ignore that group.
John Wilkonowicz, he's an independent auto analyst joining us from Boston. It's always a pleasure talking with you, John. Let's do it again.
I hope we can do it soon.
Close your eyes for just a moment and think about what America looked like in 1962. The cars, the architecture, the furniture. Well, Michigan had a major role in that look and that design. On tomorrow's show, we explore a new exhibit, Michigan Modern, Design That Shaped America. That's tomorrow afternoon at 3, right here on Michigan Radio.